In the summer of 1977, two young women, college roommates from Yale, started out on a cross-country bike trip. Just 7 days into that trip, they were the victims of a savage attack while they were camping in Oregon. A man ran over their tent with his truck, then attacked them with an axe. Terry Jentz was left with gashes all over her scalp and arms. One of the bones in her arm was sliced through. The weight of the truck crushed a lung, broke her arm and collarbone and ribs. Her roommate's skull was hit half a dozen times. She has permanent damage to her vision. In her book, Strange Piece of Paradise, Terry Jentz describes the moments just after the attacker left.
I lie on my back in a strangely euphoric solitude, eyes wide open, fully a part of this outer world, and aware that I have come up against a most unthinkable thing and have crossed over. Above me, the branches of a tree frame the sky. The world rushes in with intensity. The sharp desert air is pungent with juniper and heavy with the scent of blood. The river rushes and crickets chirp, and I think this would be any ordinary cool summer night if it weren't for the fact that I'm lying here, cut open, with a raw sensation deep inside, in places I have never known. I feel wind blowing through my veins.
While the two women survived the attack, their friendship did not. Over the years, Terry Jentz felt the trauma through rage, fear, and denial. 15 years after the attack, in 1992, she went back to Central Oregon. No one had ever been charged with the crime. She wanted to find out why and to repair her fractured self. And here was a shock. When she started talking to people in the community, they said the same thing. We know who did this.
Well, that was an extraordinary revelation. As I started to tell people my memories, I very quickly heard back from them that they had suspected a 17-year-old cowboy who was quite meticulously dressed always and known for his volatile temper and known for beating up his girlfriend and, in fact, had tried to kill his girlfriend the very next day after the attack on me.
You confront a number of these people and you say, well, if you knew who did this and you knew that he was not being investigated, was certainly not being prosecuted, why didn't you say something to protect yourself, to protect your families? What did you hear from people?
Well, they had many different stories. You know, so they said sometimes they said we didn't want to falsely accuse. Sometimes they said we thought the police were handling it. Others said, well, we were afraid if we riled him up, he would come after us. I think that primarily the reason the crime was not solved back in 1977 was that the police were expecting citizens to call in clues, and the citizens were expecting the police to solve the crime, and there was a disconnect, a lack of communication.
Hmm. One of the interesting things, I think, that you uncover as you start talking to people in this community is how close this event is to them, even many, many years after the fact, and how unresolved they feel about it, that it's not just something that's plagued you. It's also plagued a lot of people in this town.
That's the most amazing thing I think that happened to me as a result of this quest, to find this community had the same open wound that I had. They told me they were devastated by the attack, much as I had been. They helped me to solve the crime. It was really an extraordinarily heartwarming experience.
A number of the people you talked to used the word violated.
That's right. They felt that their small-town innocence was violated. I know a number of people felt that they never felt safe again going in the outdoors, going camping, going biking. There was a certain confinement that set in this community and all over Oregon, and indeed everywhere the story was told, a certain confinement that people started to feel, and I think that they didn't feel before, that you can't go camping in America without something horrible happening to you. Now, I mean, of course, what happened to me was a very rare event. However, I do think it became symbolic of a kind of mysterious danger that lurked in the wilderness of America.
You end up using a pseudonym for the man who you suspect is your attacker. You call him Dirk Duran in the book. Why didn't you use his real name?
I really do think that our culture glamorizes criminals. And if I were to use his real name, I was concerned that there would be a lot of women who would write to him and want to reform him. I wanted him to be anonymous for that reason, and also because I wanted people to think, well, maybe there's a guy in their community like him. You know, it's not just this axe man in Central Oregon who tortures women. That's not the only place where a guy like him can thrive. I also wanted to protect the anonymity of, say, his daughter and his sister, and so that people wouldn't hassle them for being related to him. There were many, many reasons. I wanted to protect the safety of the people in the community who told me clues about him. Unfortunately, he still is a free man, and I still get news of him occasionally, and he's still harassing people just as he always was.
The statute of limitations for attempted murder had long expired when you went up to Oregon, so there was no way that he or anybody else could be prosecuted for what happened to you. You do see him in court where he's being tried on other charges, and you watch him, and you know that he has seen you, and you think he knows exactly who you are. Why did you not try, though, to find him, to confront him in some way?
You know, a lot of people ask me that, and the reason is quite simple. He has denied this crime his entire life, really, and there's no way that he's going to suddenly give up a confession to me. And really, by confronting him, I would just be granting him the power to lie to me. It doesn't seem a good use of my time, nor does it seem particularly safe, because he is a dangerous character. So I've decided I will never confront him about that.
Were you ever tempted to?
I tell you the truth, I think I was tempted to assume another identity and sit down next to him in a bar and have a talk with him, so that he doesn't know who I am, and just have a talk. That would be fascinating. But actually to say, hey, I'm that girl that you chopped in Klein Falls, you know, fess up, I know you did it. No, I'm not tempted at all to do that.
Your college roommate who was with you on this trip and was also brutally attacked, she has taken a very different path. She has not wanted to go back and doesn't remember the attack, for one, but doesn't want to try to relive it. What's her reaction been to the book that you've written?
To my knowledge, she has not read the book and is not interested in reading the book. And I have to say that I'm very impressed with how she has stayed on her own course. She never wanted to hear the story. She didn't feel that hearing the story was crucial to her survival. In fact, quite the opposite. She's a doctor. She has her own way of dealing with this event. And by putting my book out there, of course, I was tempting her with perhaps finally wanting to hear the story. But as far as I can tell, she doesn't. And I think that's an act of tremendous will.
You write in the book that part of what this mission for you in reconstructing what happened was about was to try to piece together a split that you felt in yourself. Do you feel that ultimately that happened, that those pieces came together?
Of course, it's somewhat metaphorical to say that I split into two selves. But honestly, I do think that there was, you know, a traumatized self that, you know, needed integration into my public persona. And I can say, yes, I think that I did manage to do that. You know, occasionally there are triggers that bring back that trauma in surprising ways. You know, when the L.A. earthquake hit in 1994, it came back full bore, that traumatized self. I never know. I sort of live thinking that the psyche is full of surprises.
Terry Jentz, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Terry Jentz, her book is titled Strange Piece of Paradise. The attack on Terry Jentz and her roommate became a part of a book-length poem by Robert Pinsky. At NPR.org, Pinsky reads an excerpt from that poem, An Explanation of America, and he talks about how the crime became a part of his work.